Hello and welcome to the Big Technology Podcast, a show for cool-headed, nuanced conversation of the tech world and beyond. Joining us today is Zach O'Malley Greenberg. He's a longtime Forbes music editor who spent time with everyone from Justin Bieber to Kanye West, and is now writing a book about how we can see our future by looking at the music industry. And he's doing it entirely via email, something we're going to talk about. It's called We Are All Musicians Now, which is a title I just absolutely love. Zach O'Malley Greenberg, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
It's great having you, man. It's, we've been friends for a long time, and you brought me into Forbes, where I was a contributor for a couple of years. And you know, you've written a number of books about Jay-Z and you know, the music business. And you did this amazing thing, which, you know, I was like, oh, where's Zach going to go next? And you just went independent and decided to write, you know, not only write for Substack, which is an email newsletter platform many of our listeners are familiar with, but, you know, write a full book serialized on the email platform. And I think that's a fascinating move. And maybe you've learned some lessons from the people that you cover in the media industry, lessons about owning your own intellectual property and being in control of the work that you create. And I think that that's fascinating and a bold move. I haven't seen many of its kind. I haven't seen a book sent out via email newsletter before. So anyway, I'm so excited to have you on and to talk about not only the work that you're doing in the music industry, but also your personal moves and what was the inspiration behind them.
Yeah, for sure. I think to sum it up, really, I've spent my whole career chronicling the likes of Jay-Z and Diddy and Dr. Dre. And, you know, these are all figures who got where they are today, which is to say, you know, billionaire status or near billionaire status by owning their work, owning their intellectual property. And, you know, in many cases, having to fight to get it back. But, you know, I think particularly when you look at hip hop, which is, you know, something very near and dear to my heart and what, you know, kind of got me off the ground at Forbes was writing these lists of the top earning rappers or the wealthiest hip hop acts. You know, I think that in the case of a lot of these guys, it was, you know, they didn't have a choice. They, you know, were in situations in the late 80s, early 90s, where if they wanted to put out an album, record labels thought hip hop was too dangerous, you know? And so the only option was to start their own record labels and own their own masters and so forth. You know, a lot of them, you know, talking about Jay-Z, and Diddy wanted to have their own, you know, clothes, but they didn't even think about having their own clothing lines until, you know, they went to an existing clothing company and pitched an endorsement and were laughed out of the room, basically. And so then they went and started their own clothing lines. So, you know, these guys have had to overcome a lot of obstacles, obviously, that I haven't had to overcome as, you know, a white dude who grew up in, you know, in Manhattan and so forth. But that doesn't mean that there aren't lessons for everybody that, you know, that could be taken away. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have a lot of choices, you know, career-wise coming up and to not have to overcome those obstacles. But after studying these guys for my entire career, the idea of finding a way to own my own work, finding a way to, you know, control the distribution and to above all have, you know, maximal creative control, was just so enticing that I couldn't pass it up. And that's why I ultimately went to Substack. Right.
It is interesting that with the Substack, stuff that there is this, quite a similar parallel where you have people who've in some ways been forced to go independent because the mainstream doesn't really want to publish their views. And then other people who see that this is actually a good business opportunity. I think you and I probably fall into that latter category, but it does end up with the people that are doing the work, you know, owning the work that they're doing versus like when you work for a publication, I know like, you know, in the places that I've worked for, like I wrote the stories, but never owned them. It was always, you know, the publication stories, which, you know, it seemed fair. They were paying me to do it. But on the other hand, with a little more risk, I think something like a Substack where you're writing independent, you own your work and you're going to get paid by readers, or maybe get paid by Substack in some way, or maybe get paid through advertising. It's a much better situation. So I think this is a good, I do want to get into that in the second half, but I do think this is like a good segue to get into the premise of this book that you're writing called We Are All Musicians Now. And it does seem that like the stuff that comes for the rest of the world does come for the music industry first. And you and I have talked about this a bit. You say that, you know, the move to streaming content or move to the internet largely, you know, happened first with the music industry and then, you know, with the rest of media like television and movies, and also that, you know, limited release records or single release records are quite like what we're seeing with NFTs right now. So I'm curious if you could just outline your thesis for the book and give some of the parallels that we've seen the music industry lead the charge and what might be coming for the rest of us.
Yeah, you know, I think you hit on it in the preamble there. You know, that's pretty much the thesis, right? If we're all musicians now, right? If everything kind of flows through music, it hits music first, it's almost like you can tell the future by watching what happens to musicians. So
yeah, so what's hit music first?
Yeah. I would look at any number of trends. I mean, so for example, the shift from physical retail to digital, right? Who did that impact first? Tower Records. you know, and even before bookstores, even before, you know, any number, you know, even before everything was on Amazon, you were seeing Tower Records go out of business. Everything else was chugging along, and nobody was sort of like, we have to rethink our entire retail model. You know, even though the writing was on the wall, it wasn't for maybe another decade until, you know, sort of like the real e-commerce thing completely upended, you know, the way we buy and sell things, you know, to the point that it is today, right? So if you'd been paying attention to music, you know, you probably could have seen that. Then it was the shift from, you know, digital ownership to streaming, right?
So going from like buying a song through iTunes to like a subscription to Spotify, where people used to buy maybe movies or something, and now you subscribe to Netflix. Is that another thing that the music industry predicted?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the rise of Netflix or Netflix and chill, you know, that phrase has only come about in for the past couple of years. But you know, Spotify was hitting almost a decade ago. So you know, again, that's another place where, you know, even if you had seen the way things were going in music and you had just bought a bunch of Netflix stock, you know, you'd be doing pretty well. And then, I think, as you mentioned, single release albums, you know, kind of were the prophecy, if you will, you know, to kind of lay the groundwork for NFTs. So one of my favorite stories that I ever reported at Forbes.
NFTs, before we get into it, the NFTs are these essentially JPEGs are an image that you can buy ownership of on the internet. So I guess there's this interest in them because they're scarce or because they're a good place to park your crypto winnings. But you know, there's this nice part of it that it's one-off, you know, and it's original. And so, so maybe this limited release records sort of gave us I don't know, is it a bit of a stretch, but, tell the story and let me know how it connects.
Yeah, I mean, well, you tell me if you think it's a stretch. I don't. I think the first NFT ever, it wasn't even called an NFT. It was this Wu-Tang album that I broke the news of for Forbes back in 2014. And it was the strangest thing. I got an email from some incomprehensible jumble of letters claiming, you know, to be the producer of this Wu-Tang album that had been produced in secret over 6 years in Morocco. And it was so secret that even the group members didn't have access to it. And they were going to sell one physical copy for millions of dollars. And that would be it. And this person, whoever bought it, couldn't reproduce it. So it was going to be like, you know, essentially a sculpture. I ended up interviewing RZA, sort of the frontman of the Wu-Tang Clan. And he said, it's going to be like the scepter of an Egyptian king. So, you know, the in-between of all of that was pretty fascinating. Basically, I thought they were kind of scamming me. I didn't think it was real. And so I made them have, RZA DM me from his, you know, verified Twitter account in order to breathe in. And
he did. He said that, yes, we did this limited. This, it was Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. That's the album.
Yeah, exactly. And
have you listened to it?
Yeah, I've listened to parts of it anyway.
Okay.
Forbes sent me out to Morocco to keep chasing the story. And it was just this bizarre scenario. They had the album, you know, they had this handcrafted silver and nickel box produced by a British Moroccan artisan named Yahya. And, you know, he took me to his workshop and we saw how the box was made. And then they had the album itself, you know, in a private suite at this hotel where all the billionaires stay. It was just super over the top. And eventually Martin Shkreli bought it, you know, the pharma bro.
Pharma bro villain. Yeah,
exactly.
Who's playing some games to make people's prescription coverages go through the roof and is in jail or prison now.
Yeah. And ended up forfeiting the album.
Right. Who has the album now?
So that's the latest mystery. The album was seized by the US government and it was sold to an unknown buyer for at least $2 million.
Zach, how does the US government seize an album like that and just sell it? I don't remember a public bidding process. Isn't this a little corrupt?
It's bizarre. And actually a lot of the people, one of the things that I wrote about on my Substack blog was that, you know, so I should clarify, there's the book, which comes out once a week, and that's for paid subscribers only, you know, so that's in installments, Dickens style. We're all musicians now. And the other one is the, you know, I call it the Zog blog.
Your blog.
Once a week, intersection of music, media, and money. And it's all on zogblog.co, and you can subscribe for free to the blog, or you can go and be a paid subscriber for the book. But one of the things I wrote about was, in fact, that the government, you know, might have gotten ripped off. I think it was a bit of a hot potato, like you say. You know, what does the government know from selling one of a kind hip hop albums that are maybe actually better described as NFTs? And so I think they were just like, you know, let's get rid of it. Let's settle this guy's debts and move on. You know, kind of like you might sell, you know, like some incarcerated drug dealers, you know, luxury car.
Bentley.
It might not be the best price, but you know, you're just getting it out of the government warehouse. So, I think that they could have actually gotten 10 times that for the album. And that's what some of the crypto people I talked to.
The way that money is right now. Money is crazy right now. So
yeah,
people are spending money on dumb things like JPEGs.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is an actual album.
Money is kind of weird right now. I think that was an Alex Kantrowitz quote. I really love that.
Money is weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how does this relate to an NFT? I guess NFTs are digital. I think that's what makes them unique. But like, haven't there been like limited sneaker releases for a long time and all that stuff? So like creating some artificial scarcity or like
I think it's in the same vein, right? But you know, for the Wu-Tang album, what they were trying to do was to create scarcity for something that's theoretically infinitely reproducible. And that's what a NFT is, right? I mean, it's a JPEG.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great point. Okay.
So
no longer, you know, a stretch in my opinion.
Okay, good, good. Yeah. And I think that they achieved that, right? I mean, you know, sure, there are clips now floating around the internet, and Martin Shkreli did stream some of it on YouTube, and, you know, you can dig up some stuff. But like, in order to have the whole thing, you know, it almost doesn't really matter. Like if you have a YouTube clip of that album, you have a YouTube clip of that album of Martin Shkreli streaming it. But, you know, it's kind of like if you have when I was in ninth grade, I had this business. I bought a copy of Babe Ruth's original contract on eBay for $10 or $20 maybe. I paid. And then I just copied it with a copy machine and I sold it for $10.
Nice.
You know, and 33 cents for shipping and envelopes, and you know, I was making a nice profit until somebody else caught on and they bought my copy and started selling it for, you know, $5, and then the margins got too low and I lost interest. But you know, but we knew it was a copy of a copy. But that original Babe Ruth contract, you know, that's hard to fake, right? I mean, it's on some parchment scroll. I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe not a parchment scroll, but you can tell that it's an original and there's some sort of
Boston Red Sox rolled out a parchment scroll and a quill to sign the multi-talented.
It's all been downhill from there.
Yes, it has. Although Shohei Ohtani, maybe we're back in. But anyway, all right. So so NFTs. So I now buy that argument. And then I guess the last thing is that we touched on it already was people's move to own their own intellectual property. We're in a moment now where creativity is a core part of many more jobs than it had been in the past. And so maybe the music industry had also like gone through this where like, do you go through a talent agency or a record label and who owns the rights? And a lot of musicians found out the hard way that it's actually important to own your own stuff. And so maybe the rest of that's coming for the rest of us as well.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, the first chapter of We Are All Musicians Now, which is now complete and up there on Substack. But you know, I dealt with the sort of first half of, or you know, let's say the middle part of the 20th century in the music business. And really back then the default was, you know, you're just lucky to get anything for music and you know, they're gonna give you in advance a few $1,000. Maybe it's just a bottle of wine and a car. And you know, you're gonna get your music put out. But they own all your rights. And that has evolved over the decades, you know, acts like Paul McCartney fighting to get their rights back. You know, acts like Jay-Z insisting on keeping their rights and so forth, to the point where I think the default in the music business is now, you know, even if you're an up and coming act, it would be like a split ownership, of some kind. The default is no longer that the record company owns everything. And if you have a lot of leverage coming in, you know, if you're big on TikTok or if you've been indie and long enough and kind of bootstrapped it as a musician, you can insist on owning your masters and owning your publishing rights and so forth. And you know, you can keep it from the get go. You know, that's a huge change. And I think it's kind of crazy when you look at other businesses, right? How many different, I mean, certainly anything where you're creating, you know, if you're inventing things or whatever, you know, the company owns everything. And even for journalists, yeah, you know, they're paying you a salary, probably not a great salary, to write good stuff.
From journalism, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But they own the words that are printed outright. And I think that's insane. I mean, how is ideas. That not even a split? Like, you know, if you, there are stories that I've written at Forbes that still, you know, that still generate, I mean, I haven't, you know, I don't know the exact numbers, but I'm sure, you know, tens of thousands of page views a year, maybe more, just sitting there and, you know, those are being monetized and, you know, that's fine. And I have no ill will there. That's just the model. But in music, you know, you get royalties. You get royalties on your back catalog because you own a chunk of your own work. So I think that, you know, that creators are going to be demanding that across other, you know, industries as well. And the ones that can figure out a way to have kind of a more of a collaborative partnership ahead of time, you know, I think are going to save themselves a great loss of talent. You know, and I think that news outlets right now, magazines and newspapers in particular, are trying to grab onto the rights more. They're trying, you know, because of the rise of things like Hulu and Netflix, everybody wants a taste of that next big, you know, docuseries. These publications are holding on even tighter to the copyrights. And, you know, that's just not going to fly as creators become more and more empowered.
Yeah. And I want to get into that more in the second half. I guess, well, let's come into an easy landing on this one. Why is it that music is so far ahead of everything else when it comes to things like streaming, things like NFTs, if we're going to, you know, go with that, artists owning their own you know, intellectual property, creatives owning their own work, and then of course the end of retail. Why did it happen to music so much faster than anything else?
I think there's two main reasons that I look at, and one of them is very concrete, and the other one's not. And the first one is just file size. You know, MP3s or whatever music format you use, I mean, the file size is just, it's smaller than a visual medium, right? The audio files are smaller. If there's video, it's going to be a bigger file, plain and simple. And so I think that, you know, a lot of the technological changes hit music first because the stuff was more easy to move. You know, you can't really download a whole movie with a 56K modem so easily, yeah. Especially when, you know, your mom is picking up and interrupting your connection.
Try to steal a movie.
Mom. New okay. Internet. So that's one. And the other one is just hard to define, but, you know, there's that ineffable coolness of musicians, of music. You know, what makes a rock star or a hip hop act or, you know, like a big pop singer cool? You know, it's very hard to define, but there's that, that charisma that, you know, that sort of, je ne sais quoi, that comes forth from music. And, you know, I think it's just so easily, when somebody has that, it's just instantaneous, and people want it.
What's going on in music now that we should be paying attention to that's coming for the rest of us next?
Yeah, I mean, certainly crypto and NFTs, you know, like that has been a big focus. And, you know, you're seeing a lot of acts now doing limited edition album NFT drops, and maybe not one of one like the Wu-Tang Clan, but, you know, maybe like a few dozen albums or, you know, little bits of things. But I think that one thing that people are talking a lot about right now in the music is the idea of the metaverse. And sort of like owning real estate in, you know, virtual worlds and so forth. And, you know, or the notion of like virtual performances. And I'm not talking just like live stream performances, but, you know, Travis Scott, who's one of the biggest hip hop acts in the world right now, did a concert within Fortnite. And, you know, drew some incredible amount of virtual, you know, observers, right? You know, he didn't have to do anything in terms of being there himself. Mm-hmm. It was just this sort of like giant, you know, like avatar of himself that arrived in this video game sort of like on a meteor and, you know, in a purple cloud. You know, I mean, you can do whatever you want, but just so many people tuned into that. And he was also able to capitalize off of that in the physical world by tying various merch drops to this performance. So, you know, I don't know yet quite what the, you know, the you know, we're going to see like Tim Cook doing his next conference and, you know, or product launch in Fortnite. I don't know that that's going to happen, but I think that, you know, those kinds of...
We'll be spending more and more time in these video games to do non-video game stuff. You know, I have this... there's this one DJ I listen to, and she's like, all right, I'm going to do a concert. I'm like, oh, great. She's like, it's in Lego. Yeah. Lego World.
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah.
Wait, what? Like, you're actually going to show up to... But yeah, she did. And, you know, it was a big draw. So it is amazing how this is going to... I don't know. I mean, it does seem like there's going to be more movement here, whether it becomes as big as people like Mark Zuckerberg are saying. I don't know. But there is, we've talked about on the show a bunch, that people spend more time in Fortnite just hanging out mode than battle mode. And yeah. So more and more people will be hanging out in these combined spaces. And then there is actually a great place for musicians to hold concerts now. And we'll see if the rest of us follow.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think in this kind of mid-pandemic world, there's definitely more movement that direction. But this stuff was starting, you know, way before COVID. Even before Travis Scott, the DJ Marshmello did a Fortnite concert that broke all kinds of records.
Oh, yeah. How many people showed up to that thing?
You know, I don't want to get my numbers wrong, but
ballpark.
I want to say it was millions.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that true?
Sounds right. I don't have the numbers. I'm not testing you on this stuff. But yeah.
Yeah.
Wild. Okay, cool. Yeah. I want to hear a little bit more about your what you've learned from these artists and put into play in your own career. So why don't we do that at the other side of this break? We'll be back here on the Big Technology Podcast right after this. We're talking with Zach O'Malley Greenberg. And we're back on the Big Technology Podcast with Zach O'Malley Greenberg. He is the author of a new book that's coming out every week on Substack. It's called We Are All Musicians Now. And he decided to release it on Substack because, okay, let's get into it. I want to hear the story. So Zach, I was reading, and we've spoken about this in the past, so I won't pretend like we haven't. I was reading your post about how, you know, you've even foreshadowed a little bit here. You know, you worked at Forbes for a while. You took a job at a rival publication. And then over time, you decided that you just wanted to kind of own your own work and decided you were going to go it alone. I think there's a great line in your intro post. You said, "I've spent my entire career profiling monumental figures like Jay-Z and Diddy, both of whom got to where they were despite a vast array of obstacles, far more numerous and insidious than I have ever had to face. By maintaining ownership of their creations, I resolved to do the same." I mean, you hit on this in your first answer of our conversation. But it's interesting, like, that I guess in some ways it's interesting it took you so long to do something like this. I haven't seen that with these folks. But like, what was the draw of, you know, releasing your book and writing your work, not with a publication and not with a publisher, but entirely via email on Substack?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, what took me so long? You know, it's a fair question. I had a really good gig at Forbes, and I was offered what I thought was an even better gig at a rival publication. So I said my goodbyes. You know, and this is over a decade plus I'd been there at Forbes. You know, I signed my offer letter to go to the rival publication, and was given all kinds of promises about how it would be even better and so forth, and took a few weeks off.
Do you want to name the rival publication, or do you want to keep that under wraps?
Well, you know,
I don't want to cause any fights, but I have to ask you.
Gosh, I mean, I guess it's out there on the you know, it starts with the B and ends with the Business Insider.
Okay. So, got it out there. Yeah,
yeah. You know, I took a few weeks off, and I kind of, I don't know, wandered the woods and read some historical fiction and chilled out. And just before I started, I got this like 50-page, you know, what seemed to be boilerplate document, but, you know, buried in there were all kinds of, you know, we own all your intellectual property type of stuff. And, you know, I was surprised, to say the least, because I thought I had signed whatever I had needed to sign and everything was all good to go. And so I brought in my literary agent and, you know, surely this is a mistake. And, you know that I do outside books and you know, TV and film type stuff. And we tried to negotiate it into something, you know, more palatable. But, you know, they barely budged. And finally they said, you know, look, this is our final offer, take it or leave it. And I said, I'll leave it. And they said, you know, do you want to take a night and sleep on it? And I said, no. So, you know, it felt good at the time. And then I thought, gosh, all right, well, you know, this is interesting. So, you know, by that point, I already had the book pitch for We Are All Musicians Now, and I hadn't decided, you know, I was about to start pitching it to traditional publishers, and in fact was starting to talk to one who was really interested in it. But you know, this experience of like the intellectual property grab, which I think, by the way, is it, like I alluded to earlier, increasing, right? It's this idea that publications can get a piece of a Netflix or Hulu show, and you know that can be tremendously lucrative.
I guess to jump in, are publishers, like news publishers, now seeing that their reporters are turning into digital personalities? which opens up avenues for books and movies and on documentaries and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's why you think it's increasing, because they see that they have actually, and they're helping to build these personalities. Let's be honest about that, right? Like, the publications are helping increase the profile of the individual folks. And so are they seeing that they're helping open these doors and they want a cut of the proceeds? Is that what's going on?
Well, yeah, but you know, I mean, Instagram is helping build, you know, the Rock's empire, but Instagram is not trying to get a piece of his next movie. You know, I mean, I'm not saying I'm the Rock, but and to be
it's
fair,
okay. That's, you can know, say it here, man. I've seen you hit a baseball; it goes pretty far. So,
you know, the gun show element is not quite there on my end, as it is with
Mr. Johnson
over there. But no, you know, I think that's. You know, my last book is called A-List Angels, and it dealt with how stars started investing in startups, Ashton Kutcher, Nas, Shaq, people like that, J-Lo. But, you know, it also dealt with this phenomenon of, you know, I think a lot of social platforms felt they did feel responsible for building, you know, a Justin Bieber or Lady Gaga or, so, you know, somebody like that who kind of came of age at the dawn of Facebook and Twitter. But, you know, on the other end, the stars are like, well, we built those platforms, you know, if it weren't for our creativity, nobody would be going there. So I think it depends on where you come down on it. Do you believe that it's the creators or the platforms that are responsible for the prosperity, right?
Yeah. The difference is, I think that the creators aren't taking a salary. And so I do wonder if it's, I'll just like, let me articulate Business Insider's, you know, perspective here and then, you know, see what I think is their perspective, and you know, have you push back on it. But like, you know, they and other publications would say, you know, we're paying a salary, and that, you know, it's like if I pay you to help me build a house, and you build a house, and people live in it for 200 years, you know, sort of like you came in and you did your job, and just because people are living in it for 200 years doesn't mean you lost anything, you know, because of that. So like, I don't know, it is interesting to me, like. And of course, this is something that I went through also, where I was at BuzzFeed and they owned all my stories, and AdAge2 owned all my stories. You know, it felt like a fair trade for me. I was getting paid like a decent salary, and I was, you know, getting a chance to come in and do the work, and I had coaching and all that stuff. But like for now, what I'm doing and what you're doing, like we're taking all the risk here, where like we don't have a guaranteed, you know, income that's going to come in. It's sort of, it's subject to the whims of readers or advertisers. And because we're taking all that risk, we get a chance to own our work. So I guess like what I'm curious from you is like hearing that, does the publication's perspectives make a little bit more sense to you? Or, or is it just that, like, it seems like it's the best of both worlds if you work for a publication and you own your rights, and maybe a little bit too much for the worker to ask, but maybe I'm being too sympathetic to the company. So I'm curious what you think.
Well, look, no. And at the end of the day, I mean, I don't have any ill will, you know, towards, you know, any of these places.
I think
the model is broken. I mean, but I do think that, I do think it's unreasonable for them to want to own everything.
Exactly.
You know, I think that, and I think it's also not good business, because if, you know, if you're saying like, I, the publication, am going to own 100% of your intellectual property when it comes to, you know, articles being optioned for TV and film, and you will have no creative control either, you know, if one of your stories does go that way, you know, that's also like disincentivizing the writer from, you know, like, I don't know, going out and shopping it, or, you know, or kind of like trying to get involved. I mean, I talked to one, a person who'd been an editorial counsel, you know, at a big business publication. And, and the quote was like, you know, it was basically like, nobody's going to create this stuff if they're not getting paid for, you know, like 100% of zero is still zero, right?
Of course. And so not only that, who's going to want to work at one of these places if you don't share in any of the upside?
Yeah. And I think the fact is that because journalism, the salaries are traditionally so low, you know, people are like, oh my God, who's like a nice salary to go do the thing? Sure. You know, this pie in the sky movie thing or TV series or, you know, books, whatever, never going to happen. But, you know, I think that might have been more the case in the past, right? Especially with motion picture. It was very rare that anything was going to get optioned and turned into a film, you know, or a TV series. But now that there are so many more different prospective buyers and they're so flush with cash, again, Netflix and Hulu, you know, it's a much bigger slice of the pie. And I think that's why publications are kind of hunkering down and, you know, and grabbing their pieces of it, a little more strongly. Right.
Yeah. I think what we're hitting on here is a larger theme also, which is that there's a lot of competition for, good, compelling video content. You look at like what you mentioned, Netflix, Hulu, the traditional networks, upstarts like Facebook. So they all want like good video stuff. There's competition for audio now that podcasting is burgeoning. And there's competition for good work because, you know, we've moved content largely online and advertisers want to be next to good stuff. And so there's all these publications and all this demand puts, I guess a tremendous amount of power in the hands of the people that are making the stuff and are good at it. And I'm curious I'm curious what you think about that, A, and then B, do you think we're seeing some sort of shift in power between, you know, like going from the big organizations like the record labels or the publishers and to the talent?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're definitely, you know, in an era where things are shifting, but things have been shifting for decades. And I think that's part of the We Are All Musicians Now thesis, right? You know, the musicians also, after getting screwed over for so many years, realized that they could start to take more control of things. And I don't think the creators in other industries have realized quite as much, you know, how important they are. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing play out in, you know, especially traditionally lower paying worlds like media. And so it's, you know, it's going to be by studying musicians that creators can empower themselves. And kind of, you know, get what they really do deserve.
Zach, how's it going for you so far? Are you happy with the subscriber numbers that you have on the newsletter? You also mentioned to me before that you do a weekly 30-minute spot on Sirius, which is super cool. Some other stuff, maybe some TV stuff. So, you know, you're a couple months into this big jump. It all happened within the past few months. Do you feel happy to have made the transition, or are you thinking, oh God, let me just get to another publication and sign away my stuff and, you know, be done with it?
I don't want to go sign away all my stuff. No, I'm really happy with it. You know, it's just, there's so much freedom. And, you know, and I should say, I mean, there is also support from Substack. I mean, you know, they did give me a grant to come over, and you know, what happened basically was after I think I got to this point of the story, you know, a few minutes ago, but you know, here I was, and I had just said my goodbyes at Forbes, and now I had walked away from this, you know, great offer, you know, and other offer. And so I ended up, I was kind of faced with a choice. Like, do I try to go back and go to another traditional publication or do I do this thing? You know, I ended up cold calling the founder of Substack basically and just telling him the story of what I just told you. You know, and saying, hey, you know, I have this book, I want to write this book, but you know, I would love to pursue putting it out on Substack because I think that especially when you're talking about things like, you know, NFTs, crypto, metaverse, whatever, you know, this stuff is changing. Not even week by week, it's day by day. And so the idea of putting it out with a traditional publisher where, you know, the most recent thing, that, you know, that will be in a book is something that happened 9 months ago. You know, I mean, I just couldn't really envision doing that anyway. And so, you know, Substack being a startup was able to move quickly and nimbly and, you know, basically give me a grant to kind of, you know, compete with, what I could have gotten at a major publication or for a book advance. And, you know, to kind of take on some of my risk. But, you know, I guess to kind of get back to your question of like, why didn't I do this before? Frankly, it was a lot of risk, you know, and I didn't want to give up. I didn't want to take on all the risk myself. And, you know, I was fortunate that Substack was able to shoulder a little bit of it, you know, in order to get me off the ground. So, you know, I think that was all I needed to really, to kind of, you know, take the, maybe a, it's not like I was pushed off the diving board, but I, you know, I had a little nudge. And so, and I was like, all right, I'm just going to jump in, you know.
Are you going to keep doing this? Let's say, you know, is it a 1 year thing for you, or are you going to keep doing it for the next 5, 10?
You know, I mean, we'll see. I'd love to keep doing it for the next 5 or 10. I'd love for this to be like my last job ever, you know, and just keep growing it.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that I'm astonished. I thought like maybe, I didn't even think this would be a thing. And I'm, you know, well into year two of this project right now, and it continues to go, and it's awesome. It's fun to do. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, and I think the trick, as you alluded to, is basically audience development, business development. And how do you get people to find this stuff? Yeah. And, you know, I know that there's an appetite for what I write, you know, and the subscriber numbers are coming along. But, you know, I know that there's orders of magnitude more people out there who want to read my stuff because they did when I was at Forbes, and they, you know, they have, you know, for my books, and I know the numbers there. And even if I could get to a fraction of those numbers within this first year, you know, it'll be awesome. But just, you know, the ability to, I don't know, to have like a more personal relationship with your audience. I guess people could always email you or find you on social media when you were at a publication, but, you know, even just in the sort of like the tone of the stories, right? Like, you don't have to write in the voice of a publication.
Yeah. You had a great email just asking readers, hey, what should I write about? What are you interested in?
Yeah, exactly.
And I have that goes out to everyone as soon as they sign up. Tell me what you're interested in. Tell me who you are. And people do respond, and it's great to hear them hear back from them. So.
Cause it's like the, you know, the reader is sort of your boss, right? If the reader isn't satisfied, if you're not putting out really compelling stuff that, you know, that is making the reader want to subscribe or want to tell their friends, then, you know, you're not doing your job and the model doesn't work. So. You know, just the ability to do that and then to not have to worry about taking on some publication's voice or preferences or proclivities. It's just great. It's just really great.
It rules. Okay. I'm going to shout out the URL. It's zogblog.substack.com, zogblog.substack.com. Let's take one more quick break. And then when we get back, Zach, if you're up for it, I would like to do a very quick lightning round, throwing out some musicians, some artists that you've come into contact with, and maybe you can share one business lesson or one interesting fact about them that we might not know readily. Okay, so let's do that when we get back here on the Big Technology Podcast. Stick around. We'll be back right after this. And we're back here for one final segment with Zach O'Malley Greenberg. He's the author of We Are All Musicians. You can find it on Substack and also longtime Forbes editor of music covered music. Zach, you've had so many cool experiences with different musicians. So let's go through a quick tour down memory lane, and maybe you can share like one business lesson or one just life lesson that you learned from each one of them. We'll start with the big man himself, Justin Bieber.
Justin Bieber. What did I learn from Justin Bieber? You know, I think that story, I did a cover story on him in about a decade ago, and he was one of the first big names I interviewed who was investing in startups. And at the time he had just put some money into a little Scandinavian company called Spotify.
He was one of the early Spotify investors. Interesting.
He was an early Spotify investor. And, you know, I think that was kind of part of Spotify's charm offensive to win over the music industry, was to make some equity available, as they were launching in the US, because, you know, it wasn't guaranteed that they were going to make it. So, but you know, I really attribute that to Scooter Braun. So, that's his manager. Mm-hmm. And, I guess there are two lessons there, which is, you know, one, have a good manager or lawyer. But the other one is, you know, to find a way to own a piece of, you know, not only to own your own work, but to own the platform upon which it is created. And of course, that's not always possible for everybody. Not everybody's Justin Bieber and they kind of just demand a piece of it. Like, but you know, if you drive Uber, you can go out and buy some Uber stock. I don't know. I mean, it might give you more of a feeling of ownership. And, you know, I guess on the converse, I always buy stock of companies that, that I feel are overcharging me. Like my health insurance company.
Yeah.
Because I figure if they're, I'm kind of hedging my bets, you know, it's like, basically if they're going to be overcharging me, at least I'll be getting a piece of their,
some of the upside. Yeah. Okay. Moving on. DJ Khaled. Let's go quickly through these.
Oh, quickly. Okay. So DJ Khaled, sort of like a piece of advice from DJ Khaled. I think the big thing from him is, you know, he didn't get huge, hugely famous until he was in his 40s. He was a late bloomer. And he just kept hustling. And I think that's the lesson. Just keep hustling.
Okay. Katy Perry.
I think the lesson from Katy Perry is just keep learning. Katy Perry never had a sort of traditional education. I think she got her GED, but never went to high school or college. Did a cover story for her or on her for Forbes. I want to say it was 2014 or 2015. And we ended up doing the big cover interview in Rome. And her people told me to meet her at the Colosseum. And there was this whole sort of spy novel thing where I had to get in a decoy car, and it was like she was wearing this big hat. Anyway, but that's what she does at all her offerings and tours. You know, she goes and soaks up whatever the local history is to fill in the gaps in her own knowledge.
Cool.
So you know, never stop learning.
Nas.
Oh man, Nas to me is all about the pivot. Nas was somebody who came up, you know, he was always the guy who was only all about the music, and his peers, Jay-Z and Puff Daddy and Dr. Dre were getting into these, you know, business ventures. And then later in his career, Nas pivoted, again, great manager, guy by the name of Anthony Sala, got him into investing in startups. And so he got into, I think, Casper was a big one. You know, that was probably the biggest one, but I think he was in on Lyft. He was in on a bunch of different startups early. So I'd say it's never too late to make a pivot. And now, you know, he's probably the most successful venture capitalist in hip hop.
Yeah. What about Shaq?
Shaq.
I'm fascinated by Shaq. I think that dude he's such a unique individual.
I think the lesson from Shaq is, you know, never get too comfortable. And
interesting.
And I'll just share an anecdote from when I interviewed him from my last book, A-List Angels. He's a big startup investor. So, you know, we're in this like hotel room and he's in a tank top and it's the middle of summer. You know, Shaq is enormous.
And, how big is he in person?
I think he's listed at 7 feet. 300 pounds. And in person, it's like he's 9 feet tall.
But no, I want to talk, tell me about like the visceral experience of spending time with Shaq.
He his shoes are like his, his biceps are bigger than my thighs, you know? I mean, like his shoes are like, you could fit my shoes in his shoes. And so, you know, here we are talking and I said, I was basically like, dude, you know, you've made hundreds of millions of dollars in your career. Why are you even bothering getting into the startup stuff? And he looked at me, you know, big old imposing Shaq, and he says, fear.
Fear.
He says, fear. He's afraid of stagnation and he's afraid of going broke because, you know, the statistics on athletes going broke are off the charts. And so he's just constantly trying to create new business opportunities for himself. Of course, without spending too extravagantly on it. But, you know, never being complacent.
Lady Gaga?
Lady Gaga, I've never interviewed. I did have a glass of whiskey next to her at a bar one time at a Grammy after party. So I don't have any personal lessons to impart from her. I think that she's done a great job of, never being afraid, to be herself.
Oh, that is for sure.
It's not like being yourself, you lose out on some commercial aspect. I mean, authenticity is super valuable and, frankly, monetizable.
Yeah. All right. Let's wrap it up with two more.
Diddy, man. I think that the phrase that comes to mind about Diddy is can't stop, won't stop.
Yeah.
And, I've interviewed him a few times over the years and one of the things that really stuck in my mind about him, and everybody knows Diddy, the charisma and the lifestyle and all that, but, can't stop, won't stop, but especially when it comes to customer service, and the dude will go into Soho House and tell the bartender to put the Ciroc vodka, which is, it's not even technically vodka, but whatever, it's his drink, to put it on the top shelf. He will get that granular with it. And what are you going to do with the bartender if Diddy is telling you to put
You're putting it on that top shelf.
You're going to put it on the top shelf.
Yeah. We've talked a lot of hip hop. You've done some country tag-alongs too. Is there a favorite one that sticks out in your memory?
Yeah, I think the greatest country adventure was a cover I wrote about Toby Keith about a decade ago.
I remember this one.
He was launching a mezcal line and he poured me a lot of old mezcal, like there would be a worm at the bottom. So he poured me a Red Solo cup of it and basically dared me to drink the worm, which I did. And then I feel like it kind of opened
you
up.
You drank the worm.
Drank the worm.
Oh, gross. Okay. And then you wrote a book about Jay-Z and he didn't participate in the book. But then you met up with Jay-Z. How did that go? I don't know, Zach, were you planning to, whatever. I'm just going to ask it. If you don't want to tell the story on air.
No, I'm happy to tell it.
You can. Yeah. So this seems like a fun one to. So Jay would not participate. But then you and him come face to face. Let's hear the story.
Yeah. So my first book was about Jay-Z. It's called Empire State of Mind. Just released the billionaire edition over the summer. And so that's out now. But, he, over the years, as I was first writing it, his people, I reached out to them, tried to get him to, talk for an interview. And there was like, oh, maybe. And then they said, well, maybe you should rip up your book deal. And we'll maybe he'll let you write his business book. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I'll do that. So he never said no, but he never said yes. So the book came out and I didn't talk to him. And then I was at his music festival, the Made in America Music Festival in Philly, a couple of years after the book came out. And I was waiting for I was getting out of a porta potty and I walked basically right into Jay-Z and Beyonce.
God. They were waiting for the porta potty? What was going on there?
Well, I'm not sure, but the porta potties were the same for the VIP section as they were for the media tent, which is, unusual because usually
that doesn't happen so often.
Reporters are, kind of squirreled away in somewhere undesirable, but there was maybe limited space. So, I just sort of said, I just kind of improvised. I was like, hey, Jay. I'm the guy who wrote the book about you. And he pretended not to hear me and he kind of sauntered off and then he looked back over his shoulder and he said, that book was horrible. and disappeared around the corner. And I immediately ran back to the media tent and I churned out a post, which I titled, Jay-Z's review of the book I wrote about him.
Yeah.
And I essentially retold that
tale, the story. That's amazing. So
that's my Jay-Z story.
And that was it. Do you think he actually didn't like it or was he just playing with you?
I think he was just playing with me. You know, I mean, I didn't write it to please or
displease him. Of course, but, it wasn't for him. But I'm actually curious, like, what the reaction was trying to convey.
Yeah, I told this story one time. I was doing a panel with Diddy at South By, and in the green room, I was like, I don't know, what do I talk to Diddy about? And so I told him that story, and he laughed, and he said, he's playing with you. He's a good cat. It's like, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The book is We Are All Musicians Now. You can find it on Substack. That's zogblog.substack.com. The author is Zach O'Malley Greenberg. Zach, thanks so much for joining us today. It was great talking with you.
Thanks so much, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Very interesting premise, and you are cranking, and I've been enjoying reading the posts, and I encourage everybody to go sign up. Thank you to Nate Guatney for editing and mastering the audio, especially as I get my new space set up here in Brooklyn. Hopefully, Nate, it will be a little less work next time. Thanks to Red Circle for selling the ads and hosting the podcast, and congrats on your new round of fundraising. Hopefully, this party keeps going for a long while after this. And thanks most of all to you, the listeners. We'll be back next Wednesday with another show. Here on the Big Technology Podcast with the Tech Insider or Outside Agitator, we hope to see you then. Until then, take care.